Going on, Bob? How are we doing today?
Morning, Tyler. Morning to all our listeners.
Morning, night. We're not sure when they'll be listening to this at some point. How's everything going?
Good. The draft has been put to bed and working on free agency a little bit and getting ready to go away for a while.
You got your Crusaders coffee mug there, 1955 class of. That's a sacred cup, isn't it?
Escanaba Holy Name was in existence from 1955 to 1971. All right. My brother graduated in 1956, and I was a Crusader in 1970 graduate. School closed in 71. One of the five keenest disappointments in my life. I love my school completely and would have gone to games the rest of my life, tried to contribute a little money, been a huge supporter, and this great high school closed. Very, very sad day.
So what's the building now?
It's a grade school.
Okay.
K-8.
K-8, yep. So when kids, they graduate from 8th grade and then they get jobs? Is that how it works?
Yeah, the UP now? And then they go to the public school,
okay.
The Escanaba Eskimos, and the gym, beautiful gym is the still
Eskimos.
There. The Eskimos
like
is the
it.
Public school,
like
yep.
It.
The gym is the way it was, the way we played on it. The football field has fallen in disrepair, but it's basically the same field, and so a lot of memories there, yep.
Oh, man. Well, it is kind of sad if you think about it.
I know.
Yeah. But hey, we got a lot to get into today.
All right.
Another Packers podcast, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, JS Online. We're going to talk a little draft. This is the first time we've done one of these podcasts since the draft, so a lot to get into there. Did a story on human growth hormone this week, so I can talk about that a little bit. And, you know, Eddie Lacy was probably the most polarizing pick for Green Bay this draft. A lot of opinions one way or another, so we'll kind of break that down a little bit. And I know that you love draft grades, Bob, so we're going to talk about why they're so important, right?
Sure. Hit that later?
definitely. Right. Okay, so, Bob, HGH.
Well, let me begin, okay, Tyler? I mean, you spent many, many weeks on this subject, and it's kind of the skeleton in the closet. It's just bubbling below the surface, but we know now that steroids has been tested for. When I was first covering the league, steroids was abused, I would say, and it was a huge part of the game. Well, the NFL succeeded in getting that out of the game, I believe, with random testing, at least almost all of it, maybe some new strains or new ways to avoid detection. But now HGH, and as you, in your trenchant overview and tremendous study of it, there is no test for it, right? There is a test for it, but the players and the owners can't get together on it. So why don't you tell us some of the findings and discoveries you've made?
Sure. I mean, I think the NFL was ahead of the game in terms of testing for steroids, and that's what a lot of some veteran players told me. That's what the league will tell you. They were ahead of the game compared to baseball with that aspect of things. HGH is not anabolic steroids. It's an entirely different ball game. Obviously, it can require a blood test. That was kind of an obstacle at first. But long story short, when the labor dispute was settled almost 2 years ago, both sides agreed for testing to be implemented. It's been almost 2 years. Testing is still not implemented. Now, both sides have kind of gone back and forth on this. The NFL claims that they want testing. They want it to get done. They want a clean game. They want doubts eliminated. The NFLPA, I think that there's a little bit of mistrust in the commissioner. They want a fair appeals process. Either way, the perception, it's been almost 2 years. The perception is that neither side is really in a hurry to get this done.
Yeah.
And that's not good for the league because there could be a lot of skeletons in the closet. And as one anonymous player, an NFC starter, told me, quote, "It's like clockwork nowadays. Not tested and it's easy to get. Nowadays, dude, in 2013, expletive, yeah, I'm just being real." He goes on to say, quote, "I say, just like guys do it. This is our career. We're putting on for our fans. I say, HGH isn't anything. I say, do it. You're going to get hit regardless, whether you're clean, whether you're not clean. It's just a matter of how hard you get hit. I don't care who's taking it. A hit is a hit." It was some pretty strong stuff from this player. And this is an issue for the NFL. Obviously, the popularity is sky high, Bob. You saw how many people watch the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, it's year-round. The interest does not die.
And the draft.
For the love of God, they had replacement refs for a month. I mean, it took when we've talked about this play a lot, a play between Green Bay and Seattle and that public outcry to really change that. So the NFL's doing pretty well. It would be very bad business if a lot of these star athletes were tested positive for HGH. When will it be implemented? We'll see. We'll see. I don't think that there's really an end in sight right now.
The union is not going to, doesn't really want to give on this. No. They're going to talk about the validity of the tests and the taking of blood to make the test valid. So I think it's just going to drag, don't you? Neither side has a real push to want to do something about this issue.
Well, let's quote Darren Woodson. And by the way, my vote for somebody to be on Monday Night Football at ESPN, Darren Woodson, talked about somebody who speaks with clarity, insight, opinionated, played the game at a high level. Here's what he said about the holdup, about why there hasn't been anything for 2 years. Quote, they're not raising hell about it. They all know it's a problem. I don't know if they're trying to wean guys off of it or if they're trying to get as much information as they can to say, hey, this is coming at some point, but it's coming. And later on, he said, until they start testing for it, it's not illegal, right? It's just a dirty game. I've always felt it was that way, end quote.
That's the way you finished up the story, yeah. It was quite a story, Tyler. It was revealing, insightful, informative. It was just, it was balanced. It was excellent.
And it wasn't meant to be an expose or with multiple players talking about how rampant, as the one player told me, HGH. I wanted to lay out the issue and point out a problem that the NFL really does have on its hands. I know that, you know, there was the NFL side in response called that number 10 to 15 players per team is what the NFC starter told me. The NFL called that a guess. And right, it's one player's opinion. It's one player's thought. Take it for what it's worth. But the story was meant to lay out an issue that they have to deal with. Look, Major League Baseball, I'm not a big baseball guy, Bob. You are. I mean, you saw the sport really hit rock bottom in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, the popularity was soaring. It had never been higher. And then they go through the steroid era, and in public perception, the sport was demonized. Football hasn't dealt with that. And yet, here we are. Baseball's ahead of the curve. The NBA is closer to HGH testing. Mm. The NFL, compared to those two sports, is really behind the eight ball with HGH testing.
Lagging, yeah.
But
all right.
But there's one more issue with this too. All right. Well, how it's human growth hormone, Bob. I'm guessing you've kind of read a little bit of the detail on it. It's something that, as Amon Green said, we produce ourselves. You're adding more of it to your body synthetically. At what point is cheating? You know, if you have HGH testing. And there's obviously benefits to it. If there wasn't, then it wouldn't be banned. But, okay, you know, there's HGH testing put in. There's other stuff out there. This is 2013. The science evolved. I mean, Harrison Smith and Josh Norman, two DBs in the NFL, both kind of chuckled and told me, look, guys are going to find other ways to cheat. That's just what players in this league do. They're going to find other ways. So there's going to be other forms, other performance enhancers players will look for. But I think by and large, this is a place where the NFL and the NFLPA can draw a clear line. They can draw a line right here, human growth hormone. It adds mass. It adds size. Players in this league are bigger, stronger, faster than ever. There's a little bit of hypocrisy with that as well. I mean, with the NFL's emphasis on player safety, you're going to be implementing all these rules every year. And that is the number one priority for this league. And you're very concerned about head injuries, trauma, and you're changing the game in that regard, then why is there no HGH testing when that does make the players, the participants, that much bigger and that much stronger?
Who do you think wants HGH testing more, the owners or the players?
I think both sides kind of want it, but I'm not sure how much they want it. I think a lot of players do want it. Some players I talked to, they want a clean game. You saw Earl Thomas's comments. There are players who, and look, we're not saying that the entire league is fueled by HGH. By and large, most of the players go about it the right way, I think. But as far as the owners and the league is concerned, do they really want it? I mean, do the fans really want HGH testing? I'm not so sure.
They want big hits. Is that going to minimize big hits? I mean, I don't know. I really don't know. I have a hunch. I'm thinking the owners want it a little bit more than the players.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you?
I think so, too. Right, I mean, if you're a player and you're in this league, and there's a tendency to look at the stars and to attach something like this to a star. Well, was Adrian Peterson on something, the way he recovered
right.
from that torn ACL? Could Robert Griffin III be on something with his... Look, I mean, really, as Darren Woodson pointed out, when he was with the Cowboys and steroids were a lot more common in that era, it was the fringe players. It was the guys that could get cut at any moment. The players who are going into the training camp, maybe they're a second stringer, a third stringer, and they're taking a little something extra. There's a lot of those players in the league. The average lifespan in this league is 3 years. That window of opportunity to get money, to get yours, it's small. There's not testing for HGH. Those guys are going to take it. They're going to take it because look, there's too much pressure. There's too much pressure.
There's too much money to be made, obviously. Right.
There's too much money to be made. So until something's done, then this is going to be a dark cloud.
Interesting, Tyler.
Yeah. I mean, it's there's a lot of ways to look at this. I realize that. And I guess we'll see where it goes from here. But I wouldn't. Nobody should be holding their breath, I guess is what I'm saying. enough of that, though. People want to hear about the draft, don't they? They don't want to hear us blabber about HGH. First impressions of Green Bay's draft.
I do kind of, at the time, I really didn't think about it. But after I had a chance to 24 hours, I mean, the way Ted Thompson doubled up. I mean, it just didn't occur to me. But he doubled up at 5 technique with Dayton Jones and Josh Boyd, running back with Lacy and Franklin. Utility O-lineman with Bakhtiari and Treader, and wide receiver late with clones and Charles Johnson and Kevin Dorsey. So he started with 8. He got to 12. He then traded up for Franklin when he had value on the trade value chart. He finishes with 11, and he had 4 of 11 guys. He had 8 playing the same position, you know, 4 doubles.
Hmm.
Interesting way to do things. Talked to some people in the league about it, and they were impressed. Yeah.
That's a good point. I didn't think about the two players at each of those positions, but Ted Thompson doesn't say a heck of a lot. One thing he did say before the draft is a lesson he learned from Ron Wolf, the more swings you have at the plate, the better. He traded down. He accumulated some more picks. That allowed him to trade back up into the fourth round to get Jonathan Franklin, cover themselves for Eddie Lacy. There's a lot of maneuvering, a lot of jockeying in this draft that worked out for Ted Thompson.
By doing all these doubles, however, he avoided safety.
Safety.
QB. Anything else?
Well, I think the safety's the big one, right? Yeah. I mean, they had multiple opportunities to get a safety, whether it's Cyprian, whether it's Matt Elam, later on, J.J. Wilcox. There were chances early on there to grab a safety, but Dayton Jones, Eddie Lacy, address the line.
Safety's the big one until Aaron Rodgers gets hurt. Then quarterback's a real big one, Tyler.
Let's talk about that.
And they're riding the rapids with these guys right now.
I haven't really looked at that as a big need, as everybody thinks, but Aaron Rodgers goes down. What's Green Bay's record? If they didn't have Aaron Rodgers, what are the Packers?
I mean, you could say it with a whole bunch of teams that have good quarterbacks, right?
Right. But he's the richest quarterback in NFL history.
And I do think Graham Harrell, well, Pro Football Weekly had him at number 32 among the 32 backups in December. I think they ran that poll. I don't know. Graham's got to show something this summer, more than he did in those games last year. I don't know if he can win or function. He's getting older. He's certainly, you know, an experienced, smart guy. Just don't know if he has it. And they're going with him. B.J. Coleman, I don't see him beating out Graham Harrell this year. And the Matt Brown kid from Illinois State, interesting guy. Talk to some scouts about him. He's all right.
You talked to Matt Brown as well?
Yeah, I talked to him. I like what he had to say. I like the way he said it. So he's got a shot to battle in there.
I just keep going back to I sat down with Mike McCarthy last summer for a story on him and how he became this quarterback guy. And at one point, we just talked about Graham Harrell, and that was when he was really struggling in the preseason.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really struggling. That was the story of last summer.
Yeah.
It was tracking Graham Harrell. And, he was adamant, Bob. I mean, that they saw progress in him. They liked where he was at. They liked his development, and they weren't concerned. I mean, it seemed like... You know his reaction when he's asked about the softness of the team and he kind of gets a little defensive and that irks McCarthy? Kind of had that feeling with Graham Harrell last year. So they see something in him. It didn't surprise me that they didn't take a quarterback. They like Graham Harrell a lot.
Well, you know, the thing, we've seen his arm, you know, and we've seen his size. I mean, it's all just average. You know, he can't run. I mean, he can't escape. His 40 time is down. Now, Tom Clements and McCarthy both said that they thought he, and McAdoo all said that they thought he made more plays on the move last summer. I think he did. He improved in that regard, you know. He's still not really going to run away from a rush. So they know far better than we do, and they've right. got to be right on this because the odds are Aaron Rodgers is going to miss some games at some point here in the next 2 or 3 years. It's just the law of averages, and if they want to continue on, they've got to have a guy function and win.
You don't think B.J. Coleman can challenge him this summer?
I really have no idea, Tyler. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. I haven't seen enough of him. What do you think?
I mean, you got to love the guy's attitude, the way he approaches things. He's kind of a throwback in that regard, but you know, he was a deer in the headlights at some points in the preseason and obviously has a much, much stronger arm than Harrell, but Harrell knows the offense better, so yeah. We'll see where they're at this summer.
I just don't know. All right.
All right, back to the draft.
Okay.
Dayton Jones, we talked about him in our last podcast, so let's kind of focus on these later picks. You know, Eddie Lacy is the one.
Yep.
Where there's been a lot of mixed reviews out there. A lot of fans were pretty angry with the pick that they would take an injury prone, but a running back that has an injury history, somebody that the entire league passed on twice in the first two rounds. But at 61, I'm of the school of thought that that's a hell of a value for Green Bay. I mean, here's a guy that, if he's healthy, he could be that guy that really does bust those cover two defenses, gives them a 230-pound back. They haven't had a back of that size since Ted Thompson took over, really, in 2005. So if it works out, it could work out in a big way. And they covered themselves with Franklin, and they have Dewan Harris, Alex Green. I like the pick a lot.
They want to get bigger. They want to get tougher. And he's big and he's tough, you know. And that's the organizational a challenge or directive, goal, objective, mission, and that pick exemplifies it. Risk at 61? Yeah, it's acceptable. It is. Mm-hmm. He's the best back in the draft. He's better than Monty Ball. He's better than Le'Veon Bell, I think. Bell's kind of an impressive guy. I'd certainly take him over Giovanni Bernard, who's got a bunch of injuries of his own. Is he better than Kristen Michael? I don't know. Michael's got great talent now.
He's a knucklehead, though, right?
He is, and if he shapes up, if Seattle can, Pete Carroll can handle this guy, it's going to be interesting to track his career against Lacy because this guy has great numbers. So that's where you're at, and I can see them doing it. I mean, I'm still stunned that Green Bay, when they're sitting at 55, and this guy starts getting into the early 40s, mid-40s, that why they didn't trade up to take the guy if they were that enamored.
Right, right.
And then the trade back at 55 when he's in your lap, I mean, they're not that excited about the pick. I mean, you can say whatever you want, but
I thought you nailed that in your story the day after.
You go and get the guy,
there
Tyler.
There was a shred of reluctance in the pick. I mean,
yeah.
They had a chance at him at 55, and they dealt down. They deferred.
There's nothing wrong with being hesitant. I mean, the guy's got a million injuries, and this is a team that's been snake bit by injuries, and they don't want this kind of a player. But they had to take him, and at 61, makes sense. I thought it made sense at 55. I thought it made sense in the middle 40s. Had they, you know, gone up there to get the guy there.
So let's talk about the two concerns with Eddie Lacy that people may have. First, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette had the report that the Pittsburgh Steelers basically took Eddie Lacy off their board because toe fusion surgery he had before his final season at Alabama. Obviously, a lot of teams knew about this because a lot of teams passed him over. That's concern number one. Concern number two would be, look at the guys he was running behind. Chance Warmack, DJ Fluker, Barrett Jones. We're talking about an NFL-ready offensive line. How much of his success was a product of that line? Let's go to the first one, the injuries. You've talked to these scouts. What did they say about Eddie Lacy?
All right, so the toast, what'd one guy say? He's beat to hell and back. I mean, you read those 18 or 19 scouts' comments on, you know, that's the best way to look at these players is right in the horse's mouth, and that's what these guys give you is exactly what they told me.
Beat to hell and back.
Yeah. Oof. Missed a bunch of games in a senior in high school, you know. All right, he had the turf toe surgery. People don't know about turf toe. It's basically, Jesse Clark, the old Packer fullback, once told me, just take the big toe on your foot and jam it straight up towards your shin when you're standing, and that toe basically touches your shin. So all the stuff at the base of that toe is just haywire, smashed, and then you got to have surgery. It's a nasty, terrible injury. Everybody used to have it on artificial turf, and now it's you don't hear much about it on grass and field turf.
Sounds incredibly unpleasant.
It's a bad thing. All right, now I'm told in 2011 he's got a torn pec. Now, I know there's degrees of torn pecs, but he had one. To this day, it's bothering him. He couldn't lift to the combine or at pro day because of this pec. Now, he's played through it. All right.
Herschel Walker only did push-ups, right? So he doesn't need the bench press.
Right. All right, he's got a hand. He had 7 screws put in his hand late in the season. After the Georgia game, he comes back and plays against Notre Dame. He plays with this thing. I mean, the guy is described by some of these personnel guys as like superhuman, untouchable, or undeniable. But now the hits are going to be a lot harder, right?
Right.
And he hasn't had many touches. Can he hold up? I mean, I don't think he can, and that's why they went and took Franklin. I can't imagine how he could hold up through 300 touches in an NFL season. The odds are against him.
You know, I will say this. The tight end on Alabama, Michael Williams, said Eddie Lacy didn't miss any practices. He was dealing with the toe. He was dealing with things that he never sat out, practiced through it, played through it. He's averaging over 6 yards a carry in the SEC. Highly, highly productive guy. He had injuries and he played through them. There's a value to that, that nothing could really hold this guy down, that he was playing through these things and was the best running back in the country. So I hear you. I mean, maybe he does break down at some point, but there is some appeal there that things couldn't really hold this guy down. I mean, how many times are little nicks with running backs, little hangnails keeping him out of games? It's not Eddie Lacy.
He's superhuman.
He's a confident, borderline cocky guy. I think you like that in a guy like Eddie Lacy, saying he's about as complete as it gets at the running back position, that he'll do whatever he needs to do. Even if they didn't draft Jonathan Franklin, I thought that was a great pick. The other concern, running behind a great line, you've covered a lot of these drafts with running backs who have run behind NFL caliber offensive lines. To you, how do you think NFL teams viewed Eddie Lacy in light of the fact that he's running behind the 11th overall pick, Warmack? Where did he go?
Tyler, I never heard it once. Nobody in discussing Lacy ever talked about his line. I think they just kind of take that into consideration and they see a body, they see a tape, they see a play, and they see what he does. Not one person mentioned the caliber of the great Alabama line. I don't know.
Well, I think that's pretty accurate because talking to Warmack and now Williams themselves, they said that Eddie Lacy is a great back in his own right and they don't want to put themselves down, but there's a reason that he was highly rated and the number one back in the draft. So we're going to see what happens. And not sure where this will leave the other backs. Dewan Harris, Alex Green, James Starks. What's their prospects heading into training camp?
Not good for Greener and Starks, I wouldn't think. I mean, based on what Dewan Harris showed, Franklin's going to be here. Lacy's going to be here, barring injury. They keep 3. They could keep 4. Coon's the fullback, unless he gets beat out by somebody. Or they want to keep Stoneburner maybe as an extra tight end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not good. It's going to be competitive. They'll try to be trading these guys, I would imagine, in the next couple months. I don't know if they'll have any luck.
They like Dewan Harris a lot. I mean, Mike McCarthy has been gushing over him a few times since the season ended and said he'll have his chance to be the number one back and to be a big part of the offense. So you have to think he's going to get a fair shot. And I mean, Alex Green, the guy tears his knee as a rookie, comes back, had a pretty rough start as the starter, but he turned a corner and was playing pretty well toward the end of the season before he ended up on the sideline. Hasn't really gotten a full shake. I mean, I think you'd want to see what you have in him still, too.
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, to a point. But if you can get something for him, you do it. You know, he's got a contract that's still easy to trade. Same with James Starks.
Right.
So, I don't know. Starks helped them win a Super Bowl.
He did.
I mean, he's kind of regressed with injuries. He's hurt all the time. He's had some problems in the passing game of receiving and blocking. But still, when you give him the ball, I know Eddie Lacy is really, really tough, but Starks can be really, really tough too.
By and large, Green Bay had to do this offseason what they didn't do last offseason. When they went in the training camp last offseason, they had James Starks, Alex Green and Brandon Saint. Green coming off the knee. Starks, you know about his injuries in the past. And Brandon Saint's an undrafted pickup the year before. They're pretty confident they'd be fine there. Starks goes down. They scramble. They pick up Cedric Benson. More guys get hurt during the season. They scramble. They pick up a car salesman. More guys go down. They scramble. They pick up Ryan Grant, who they wanted nothing to do with earlier in the year. So they're doing what they didn't do last year. And then they're covering their butts, and they're giving themselves options. So I think you have to do that if you're the Packers and you're Ted Thompson. I don't know who the number one guy is going to be. I don't know who will be around, but you have to have multiple players. I mean, Alex Van Pelt, his first year on the job, he's training a different running back almost every week. This year, it's not going to be like that because they have so many different ways to go.
You know, the need for excess backs, you're dead on with that. We're talking about Lacy, and optimistically, you know, we're both, I mean, fans, most fans are seeing it that way. You and I have talked optimistically. But then when you think back of the Packer history of drafting backs in the first two rounds since John Brockington in 71, well, then you start to see how these things can go haywire in a hurry at this position. Who do you start with? Barty Smith, first-round pick in 74. I mean, he's a huge guy. He looks like a fullback, but he was their back, and he got hurt after about 2 or 3 years, and he was gone. In 79, they take backs 1 and 2, Eddie Lee Ivory. I'll just review this a little bit, Tyler, for some of our younger listeners who've never heard of these guys.
Hey, I'm a younger co-host here, too.
And they come back, Dick Corrick and Bart Starr come back with Steve Atkins from Maryland in the second round. Eddie Lee Ivory, I mean, anybody who saw an exhibition game that first year and he ran a screen pass against the Chiefs out at Lambeau for like 75-yard touchdown, the burst, the explosion, the elusiveness, it was incredible. He would have been a franchise back. Opening day at Chicago, tore up his knee. A year or two later, opening day at Chicago, tore up the same knee. I mean, he became a serviceable back, much to his credit, but the greatness was gone because of injury. Steve Atkins, I mean, he had great talent, just couldn't play, couldn't fit. He was a complete disaster. We go to 86, Kenny Davis, second-round pick. He was all right.
TCU?
He had good, yeah. He never made it here.
Buffalo.
It was a bad football team. Yeah, and he goes to Buffalo, and he played well on those Super Bowl teams. The next year, they take Brent Fulwood with the fourth pick or fifth. Highsmith went third, and he went fourth. And Brent Fulwood is a bust. Couldn't catch. Didn't know the playbook. Had one big game out in San Francisco, their biggest victory in about 25 years, but he's a total bust as the fourth pick. Who's next on the hit parade at running back? Darrell Thompson in 1990. Right. They took him right after Emmett Smith went to Dallas, but I was told that Green Bay would have taken Thompson anyway over Smith. Darrell Thompson came from Minnesota Golden Gophers. Just an eye back. Didn't have the wiggle, narrow-based runner. It just didn't work. He was here 2 or 3 years. And who's their next? They didn't take any back then Brandon Jackson.
Well,
in the first two rounds.
First two rounds you're talking, right.
And Brandon Jackson, we all know about him. He's just a guy. Now, they made it happen with Amon Green, Dorsey Levins, Edgar Bennett, Ryan Grant, either by trades or mid-round picks. So it looks good on Lacy now, but everybody needs to know that the thing can turn into a complete disaster.
Well, I mean, this is probably the big reason why Ted Thompson drafted 3 running backs total in his first 8 drafts. He just has not drafted that position in general, you know, first 2 rounds, whatever. Just hasn't done it. And this year they take 2 in the first 4 rounds. I mean, it does show an urgency that they have to somehow get teams out of those cover 2 looks. They have to have balance. The commitment was there toward the end of last season. I mean, mm-hmm. I know McCarthy gets killed by fans sometimes, and rightfully so. That game at Seattle, we can talk about, you know, the Hail Mary and all that, all we want. Big reason they lost that game is Rodgers is sacked 8 times in the first half, and Cedric Benson had 2 carries in that half. Hmm. I mean, they just completely were trying to spread it out and force the issue. But toward the end of last season, McCarthy was running the ball. I mean, and they were a top 10, top 11 rushing team as a unit the last half of the season. Mm-hmm. So there's a little promise there. They're trying, and now they have multiple players to go to. We'll see if Eddie Lacy works out.
Yep.
You look back in time like that, and it's a tough position to to hit on. Well, at least they got a solid offensive lineman in Tony Mandridge, though, right? That was a good way to go that year. All right, Bob, any other picks you want to talk about that stand out to you? Late round, a guy who could surprise and maybe make an impact this year?
Well, let's go to Nate Palmer. You just did the story on Nate Palmer. I kind of like him. I mean, I know people who've been around him, they feel he exudes physicality and mm-hmm. toughness. He's been in the Big Ten for 3 years at Illinois. I don't know. I talked to two guys on Sunday. They didn't think it was a reach to take him sixth round, 193. All right, so how do you see Nate Palmer?
Well, it's interesting how this all came about. I mean, Kevin Green went down to Illinois State. Well, first of all, the Illinois State defensive line coach reached out to all pass rushing, D-line, outside linebacker coaches within a seven-hour radius of Bloomington, Illinois,
right?
NFL coaches. And Green's the first one that got back to him. He said, look, I'll come to you, Kevin. I'm from Wisconsin. And Kevin Green said, no, stay there. I'm passing through. They spent the day together. The coach helped Green out with pistol stuff. They see a lot of pistol formations at the college level. And Green helped him out just with the bull rush, different pass rushing moves. And that's kind of when he learned a little bit more about Nate Palmer. Green Bay's interest grew. I mean, here's a guy who didn't have any other visits, didn't even expect to be drafted, but an Illinois transfer, caught on at Illinois State, does have experience rushing, standing up. An upside pick. I mean, didn't really face great competition in college, but a good edge rusher and good guy to talk to. I mean, you can tell that he's somebody that gets after and is going to have that temperament, and that can be hard to find at the position. Mm-hmm.
Want to go to Micah Hyde for a second? The fifth round pick, cornerback from Iowa, 5'11 and a half, which is their required size, 194, ran 4.57. So he was the 23rd corner taken, and with those numbers, it seems about where he deserved to go. He's got size. He doesn't have the great speed by any means, very, very average speed for the position. He's a smart guy, started for a couple, 3 years, pretty good ball skills. Tackles okay, and he's a good special teams player. So I pointed out, I think he's going to be competing with Jarrett Bush for that last cornerback spot slash special teams ace. And Jarrett Bush will not go down without a fight. He is the greatest practice player on this roster, and he is enthusiastic as anybody, and the guy will not go without a fight. We know that.
It is interesting that they went slot corner special teams route with that fifth round pick, as opposed to safety. There are still some safeties on the board there, so it seems like that will be the competition, as you noted. Doesn't have a lot of speed, so probably not somebody you want to just leave out there on an island, right?
Right. Let's look at some safeties who are left at that point, Tyler, okay? Hyde goes off at 159. Safety Josh Evans from Florida goes 169. There's some mental shortcomings there. A guy from Notre Dame, Jamoris Slaughter, a really good player who's just coming off a torn ACL, Achilles late in the year. Bakari Rambo, there's the man.
Right.
He slipped to 191. He goes to Washington. He's the Georgia safety. A lot of picks, a lot of ability to run a secondary. But boy, even again as recently as Sunday, once I asked a scout about this, he said, you know, when you're around Bakari Rambo, you just see character flaws.
Wow.
You just see a guy that, he said it, could be headed for a suspension. So Green Bay stayed away from that. Very interesting, though, and Rambo was on that board.
Everybody was wondering why he slid. That's probably the reason why. I mean, his teammate Sean Williams went in the third round, and they were kind of considered one and the same, interchangeable.
I was around Bakari Rambo during his entire interview at the Combine. Did you remember? Were you part of that one?
I was not, no.
I can. What this scout said, I can see where he's coming from.
Right.
John Boyette's a safety from Oregon who's also injured. Zeke Mata would be the next safety from Notre Dame. He looked like a second or third round pick before the combine. I mean, this is a real good player for Notre Dame.
Like a 4.9?
4.78.
4.78.
He couldn't get any better at pro day. He goes in the seventh to Atlanta. I mean, I like Zeke Mata, but the whole league thinks he can't play in this day and age. And the other one, I guess, of interest, there's two more. Damon Stafford from Nebraska, kind of a box guy. He's got pretty good ability. Lasted a long time to the seventh. And Don Jones, a workout phenom from Arkansas mm-hmm. State, which produced M.D. Jennings. Don Jones is 4.41. Yeah, so he goes in the seventh. So Green Bay didn't take a safety.
Right. So they go with Micah Hyde, and I guess in the secondary, you're going to take the best available players. You can never have enough corners, cover guys, players around the ball, and they go with Hyde. We'll see what happens.
Yep.
What about draft grades, Bob? I know you wanted to touch on that.
So everybody and his brother does a draft grade, right, Tyler? Mm-hmm. We don't do it at the JS. Talk about filling space, huh, with nonsense. I mean, come on.
Hey, that's the NFL's year-round. It's a lot of nonsense.
To me, it's just complete garbage, you know. I mean, how can the average writer possibly, they're looking at these, at a team's draft, and they're looking at it, and they're seeing guys from big schools. I mean, what is the average writer or guy dealing out these guys? What does he know about a guard from James Madison, Earl Watford? I mean, he doesn't. But Earl Watford, you know, I mean, if you're into this stuff, he's really a good athlete, and he's got a real good chance. But they would downgrade a team for taking Watford compared to maybe the guy from Kentucky who's been in the SEC, Larry Warford, who they know. It's just silliness. It's how many picks you got.
Isn't it a lot of groupthink too?
It's based off what people on TV have been saying for the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 months, ad nauseum, day after day after day. At least I think. I don't pay attention to any of it, but you know. And it's looking at big schools, it's named players. It's not seeing a guy from Harding by the name of Ty Anthony Powell who played pretty well in the Senior Bowl. Most people don't know anything about him. It's foolish. But I suppose it's well read. I don't read them, and I'm not doing them.
I'm going to throw three things at you, Bob.
Yes, sir.
You tell me which one you like best. All right. Instant free agency grades. Winners and losers in free agency. NFL draft grades.
Yeah.
Or the 2014 NFL mock draft right after the 2013.
Oh, those, huh?
Those are great, too.
That's good stuff. Instant gratification, you know, appealing to knee-jerk. Right. Nonsense. It's water cooler stuff. But why does this give the media a bad name, the superficiality? It's just garbage. It's top 10 lists. Everybody's got a list on top fives, top tens, top this, top that. Come on. I mean, yeah, these were fun in the media 20 years ago when they just started. I remember doing them at the Press Gazette. And they were great, a high five, and it was a heck of an idea. Nobody else was doing anything like that. But it is so overdone now. Come on.
The bells and whistles, people love them nowadays.
Fine.
Okay. Well.
Sorry, Ty.
Hey, I'm with you. I think it's ridiculous as well. So, Bob, around the division, anything stand out with you? Vikings, Lions, Bears?
You start out about the Vikings. The Vikings made some headlines, didn't they?
Three first-round picks. They had Shreve Floyd fall right into their laps. They get a great corner, Xavier Rhodes. And Patterson, who, you know, you had some pretty scathing stuff from scouts on his ability to adjust to an NFL offense. We'll see if he pans out. But to get him at the end of the first round with a Greg Jennings, that seems like a pretty good spot for Patterson. You have to like what Rick Spielman's done with the Vikings. And isn't this a perfect example of there's some teams in the league where you don't really know who's in charge? You know, the Buffalo Bills for a while, you know, Russ Brandon, Ralph Wilson, not really a GM, and now they have Buddy Nix as a GM. The Vikings, it was a similar situation, kind of a triangle of authority. They make Rick Spielman the undisputed GM, and he has had two. Well, here I go with instant draft grades. Last year's draft turned out to be pretty solid, and this year's has a little bit of promise. So you have to like where they're going right now.
All right, so Floyd, he fell because he's got short arms, right? 31 3/4. You got to think that's the main reason. All right, so he's in a perfect. He should be with a 4-3 team, and he is with one. He's a 4-3-3 technique. He could be really good, Tyler.
You know, I think he fell. At the combine, he said he watched Disney instead of football growing up.
Kiss of death.
Yes. The old Disney kiss of death there. You see it every year.
How did he get to 23? I had him third in the mock draft, and I thought that was just based on where he should have gone as a player. All right, so now Xavier Rhodes. He fell pretty far, too.
Physical, aggressive, in-your-face, corner. You don't see those every year.
Physical in coverage, not so much physical as a tackler. Mm-hmm. He's not the next Antoine Winfield slicing people down. But he walks in as a starter opposite Chris Cook and whoever else they got, but he's going to start. All right, Cordarrelle Patterson. Yeah, terrible interviews with teams at the Combine. Low test score. He's got to really learn from Greg Jennings. Greg Jennings is a master at this kind of stuff. And Greg Jennings is going to have to get this guy under his wing. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons the Vikings felt they could do it. They have Greg Jennings, the master craftsman, smart as a whip. Remember, he came in that 06 season and learned that system unlike any wide receiver that's been in Green Bay. And now he's got to do it with Patterson.
I mean, yeah, he's in a good situation coming in. I believe this was the first part of your pre-draft series. I could be right. With the wide receivers, it had quite a reaction when you included Patterson's Wonderlic score. Can you just tell the listeners, and we've talked about this in the past, why you include Wonderlic scores, why it's important, and why teams care?
Well, teams all have these scores, and I try to provide the readers of JS with as much information as I can. And if I can obtain these scores, I'm just doing it as a service to the readers. Now, we could get into all the sociological discussions, explanations for the Wonderlic, but I don't really quite have space to do that in every story. I think my readers now, we've been doing this for 25, 30 years, and they know what the Wonderlic is. It's a quick 12-minute, 50-question summation of basic intelligence. Yes, it can be culturally biased. This has all been written about many, many times over the last 15, 20 years. People poo-poo this test. It's a mistake. Teams use this thing a lot, and they put stock into it. It's a pretty important part of the puzzle. It's not as big as the tape. It's not as big as that 40 time, but it is pretty big, and to minimize it, is foolish. It's nonsense to minimize it because it's important. Now, these scores, I could have written a story talking about Tavon Austin and Cordarrelle Patterson. I didn't sensationalize these scores. I never have. I just put it in the story just the way teams are analyzing their boards, analyzing each player. You go into any draft room around the country, I guarantee it. They got a card on every player, and you got height, weight, speed. And you got an injury, a 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 on the degree of medical risk, and you got that Wonderlic score. That's a quick thing, and it shows intelligence. Now, the NFL gave this one-hour-long test at the Combine this year for the first time. They thought longer, so it's 5 times longer. It's going to be more into it. And then I talked to one personnel man, and he just thought the thing was ridiculous. They didn't pay any attention to it. Right back to the Wonderlic. Not sensationalizing, just providing information.
So this new intelligence test that came out, and it came out as an alternative form of a better test,
they hoped, yep.
And it didn't work out. They went back to the Wonderlic.
This team didn't pay any attention to it. The Wonderlic...
Well, look, there's players who have run great 40s, who have run bad 40s, who have panned out, who haven't panned out. There have been players who have scored great on the Wonderlic, who scored poorly on their Wonderlic, who have panned out, who haven't panned out. You're including something that teams use in their evaluations.
Right. If a guy has a low test score, then they're darn well going to find out why, and they're going to invite him to their building. They're going to talk to him at the Senior Bowl. They're going to talk to him at bowl games. They're going to send people to that campus. They're going to get into it, mm-hmm. and they're going to put that player on the board, and they're going to see if he can learn football. That's what it's all about. Can he learn football at our pace? Some guys with a low test score just can't do it, and they find it out. It's a red flag. Some with a low test score, I was told Tavon Austin is one of these players. He can learn it. He's applied himself at West Virginia, and he's into football, and he can think on his feet. And right. He can know football on his feet. That's the litmus test.
So maybe somebody like Austin was able to get on that board and draw things up. Look, if you want to use me as that Percy Harvin threat, here's what I can do. Another receiver, may not be able to go up on that board and may not be able to draw those things up. And he may happen to have a poor Wunderlich score as well.
Let me mention this. You know, players are repped a lot by agents during that. They leave school at the end of December or after their bowl game. They go to these workout centers in generally in warm weather climates, January, first 3 weeks in February, preparing for the combine. There are many versions of the Wunderlich test and the corresponding key answer key that goes along with it. And agents have these from over the years, veteran agents, and they have their players taking this test. Just a form of the test, not the one they'll take at the combine, a different form. And they take this like every day, sometimes twice a day. I've talked to players about this. And the scores are considerably higher at the combine than they are the first time a player, a senior who's entering his fourth or fifth year, a legitimate senior, the first time he takes that is in March, before his senior year, so 11 months before the combine. Those scores, he's not repped up. Those scores are lower and considered more legitimate by teams. Can I mention one more thing, Tyler, on this? And if a guy gets a high score, you know, max is 50. Only one player in history, the Bengal punter Pat McAnally, ever had a 50. Okay. That's 30-some years ago. He was an Ivy leaguer. If a guy gets the 38, I look for high scores in my series as well. I mean, I put as many high scores in as low scores. And at some positions where the score to me is somewhat meaningless, I don't even put any of it in there. I'm not trying to sensationalize these scores. I'm just trying to provide our readers with, obviously you're never going to get as much, but somewhat of a feel for each player that's in this series.
Right.
That's it. And, you know, I know I've been criticized, ridiculed, and all this. Well, fine, you know. If all those people want to have their head in the sands and you know, pretend this stuff doesn't exist, they have no idea what the value of this Wunderlich is and how it's used, fine. These are just people that, you know, really don't have a clue about the process, and they think it's all, you know, sweet and saccharine and all this. Well, that's ridiculous.
Well put. Well put. Well, hey, we'll see how all these picks work out. Rookie minicamp, May 10th, May 11th, May 12th. OTAs, minicamp, and then training camp right around the corner.
Good stuff, huh, Ty?
It's coming fast, Bob.
Yeah, man.
Well, hey, that's going to do it for us at this Packers podcast. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. We'll do it again here sometime later.
Thank you.
Stop.